Welcome to today's SNEB Journal Club webinar. We're featuring authors from the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, and we're celebrating the FAO Year of International Year of Fruits and Vegetables. So my name's Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB. And just a reminder that the JNEB, the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, is the society's peer-reviewed journal, and JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. The Fall Journal Club is sponsored by our publisher, Elsevier. So if you're not a member of SNEB, welcome to the Journal Club. And then just a reminder to SNEB members that free access to the live and recorded webinars is a benefit of membership. So as we begin, a little bit of housekeeping. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, there is a handout tab and you can download the slides for today's presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenters. When I close the webinar, there will be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as any comments for future Journal Club webinars. And then watch for an email later this week, which will include the link to the recording, the handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. So I will turn things over to our moderator. Dr. Kristen DiFilippo is a teaching assistant professor at the University of Illinois.
Thanks, Rachel. Today I get to introduce our three presenters. The first, Dr. Mary Kristoff, is currently an Associate Director of Health Economics and Outcomes Research at Alexion Pharmaceuticals in South San Francisco. She earned her MPH and PhD in community health on the epidemiology track as a fellow in the Illinois Transdisciplinary Obesity Prevention Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She performed her postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Minnesota Department of Pediatrics and Division of Epidemiology and Community Health, where she worked as part of the Project EAT team. Her research focuses on investigating longitudinal trends in health behaviors and synthetic control arm analysis. Dr. Nicole Larson is a senior research associate in the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. She is a registered dietitian with expertise in public health and the promotion of healthy eating and weight-related behaviors. Dr. Larson has built expertise in behavioral promotion of healthy eating are in behavioral epidemiological research in the role of project director for the Project EAT, Eating and Activity Over Time, Longitudinal Studies of Eating and Weight-Related Problems, and her involvement in research related to school nutrition environments. As part of this work, she has authored more than 150 peer-reviewed manuscripts relating to research methodology and eating and physical activity behaviors. Dr. Larson is a member of the Nutrition Graduate Faculty in the School of Public Health and in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Vivian Hazard is a T32 Fellow in the Midwest Regional Postdoctoral Training Program in Eating Disorders Research. Her current projects aim to elucidate risk and protective factors for eating disorders and other internalizing disorders, such as mood and anxiety disorders, as well as to identify and understand disparities in risk and diagnosis by sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. Vivian intends to translate this work to inform the development of transdiagnostic prevention programs for socially and economically disadvantaged groups. Today, they're going to be sharing their work that they did that was published in JNEB, Intuitive Eating is Associated with Higher Fruit and Vegetable Intake Among Adults. I want to thank them all for being here today, and at this point, I can pass it on to our speakers.
All right. Do we have the screen good for everyone? Okay, perfect. All right, thanks so much. I especially want to thank Nicole and Vivian for being here today to co-present, and SNEB for inviting us. We are really excited to share this work. So next slide, please. First, we have many different people and teams that we want to acknowledge that were a part of this work. So first, we want to thank the Project EAT team and the survey participants. Additionally, Project EAT is funded by a number of different NIH grants. Those are listed here on the slide. And these, Diane Newmark-Steiner is the PI for these. And these are, of course, the foundation for this work in addition to many, many other studies. Additionally, both Vivian and I and our postdocs were funded by T32 grants, which are listed here and we want to acknowledge. And overall, we declare no conflicts of interest relevant to the current work. In terms of the overall outline, some of the things we'll discuss today are first the nutrition educator competencies, the background and conceptual framework. Here, Nicole is especially going to speak about the Project EAT study design and some of the framework for that. The methods, of course, the overall results of the study, and then Vivian is going to go through the discussion and some of the implications for research and practice. Next slide. First, in terms of the nutrition educator competency, so we'll look at some of the basic approaches to understanding diet and health relationships. Especially intuitive eating in this case. Next, we'll look at some of these behavior and education theory that underlies both dietary intake and intuitive eating. And then last, we'll look at analyzing, evaluating, and interpreting nutrition education and research and the application to practice. Next slide. All right, so what drives dietary intake? A couple different factors. So first, we have some internal factors, things like hunger, emotional cues, boredom, sadness, grief, happiness, some of these internal factors that impact dietary intake. But secondly, we have external factors, food availability. Do you have different distractions within the environment? Social context, are you eating in a restaurant with a huge group of people? Palatability, how appealing is the food to you? And also things like portion size. So the concept of intuitive eating is defined as the practice of making choices about when and how much to eat based on physical hunger and satiety cues rather than external cues and rules. So it's going to be much more these internal factors compared to the external factors. Prior research, most of which is based on cross-sectional studies, has found that intuitive eating is positively related to good psychological and health indicators like emotional functioning, lower risk of eating disorder symptomology, and lower risk of high weight status. Next slide. The current conceptualization of intuitive eating involves four main components. So the first is reliance on hunger and satiety cues. Second, eating for physical rather than emotional reasons. Third, unconditional permission to eat. And fourth, this is probably less easy to explain, but the practice of gentle nutrition involves making food choices that honor health as well as tasting good. This is also called body food choice congruence. And it especially gets at the idea that this is sort of a holistic thing. An intuitive eater is really eating in a way that, they think about how the food will make them feel afterwards, and they're eating to nourish themselves, not necessarily get just a certain number of calories to, keep them running physically. In terms of some of the previous research, few studies have really investigated the relationship between these four main components or all of these components. and different aspects of dietary quality. And for those that have, no real patterns have emerged. One of the weaknesses with this is that, of course, every study has a different way of looking at dietary intake. So some studies might use dietary indices. Others might look at total calories or sugar intake. But one of the primary gaps is that, of course, in the U.S., we have the U.S. dietary guidelines, and there isn't really strong research in terms of looking at how intuitive eating relates to intake of the different components included in the dietary guidelines. Next slide. So with that, the aim of this study was to look at cross-sectional associations between intuitive eating and dietary intake in a large population-based sample of men and women. And with that, we will transition to Nicole, who is going to give you that overview of the Project EAT study design.
We addressed the aim, as Mary laid out, to look at the association between intuitive eating and dietary intake using the Project EAT longitudinal study, which has two cohorts. The first was started in 1999, and the second started in 2010. These two studies both involved young people who were enrolled in middle school or high school in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area at the time the studies began. And the second one was started in order to allow for examining secular trends and the broader range of environmental variables that may influence eating activity and weight status. Today, we're going to focus on the original cohort, the one that was started in 1999, and specifically on the fourth wave of follow-up in 2015-2016. Here you can see the research that we're studying allows for investigating environmental, personal factors, and behavioral factors that influence eating, physical activity, body image, and weight status over the life course from adolescence to adulthood. And the different variables shown on this slide can give you a broad sense of the types of questions that were asked on the surveys. It included questions about numerous different factors that influence eating behavior, with among them at the fourth wave, the reason we're focusing on the fourth wave is that's the first time that participants were asked about the behavior of intuitive eating. At that fourth wave in 2015-2016, a number of participants had moved outside of Minnesota at that time. Approximately 70% of them were still living in the Twin Cities metropolitan area of Minnesota, but 30% of them at that time had moved to other states across the country. At the time of the E4 study in 2015-2016, these young people were ranging in age from 25 to 36 years, with a mean age of 31 years. When they were followed up, this was the 15-year follow-up, we had 1,830 of them respond to invitations that were sent via USPS mail. And that represented a 66% response rate of those we were able to contact. The majority of participants responded online, and 1,817 completed the intuitive eating scale. The survey they completed included measures of demographic and behavioral characteristics, so they reported on gender, age, their race and ethnicity, their income, and their education. And the measure of intuitive eating was a 7-item scale that was adapted from previously validated scales that were developed originally by Tracy Tilkla and her colleagues, the Intuitive Eating Scale and the Intuitive Eating Scale 2. Given the space constraints of the survey, so we would not have excess participant burden, we focused on a total of 7 items that came from 2 subscales, the Reliance on Hunger and Satiety Cues subscale, and the Eating for Physical Rather than Emotional Reasons subscale. So, for example, participants indicated their agreement with statements including, I trust my body to tell me when to eat, I trust my body to tell me what to eat, and also I stop eating when I feel full. They reported their dietary intake in response to a food frequency questionnaire that was developed by the Harvard School of Public Health. And they were asked to think about their usual intake over the past year and report on foods including fruits, vegetables, whole grains, dairy foods, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Those reported intakes over the past year were analyzed, and so what we were able to look at is average daily intake of food groups, beverages, and other dietary components, including total energy intake, total fat, saturated fat, and protein.
All right. With that, we will switch to the analysis. Thank you so much, Nicole. So as Nicole has just mentioned, the intuitive eating scale was based on responses to 7 different questions, most of which were from the Reliance on Hunger and Satiety Cues scale. Overall, the responses range from strongly disagree to strongly agree. So if a participant marked strongly disagree to each of the 7 items, they would get a score of 7. And if they marked strongly agree, they would get a score of 28 for all of those 7 questions. Overall, then, those scores were stratified into quartiles. And then the quartiles were derived separately for men and women, and all analyses were stratified by gender. This was done for a couple different reasons. First, some research in the U.S. has noted that there are differences in awareness of intuitive eating. So men are less aware of the concept of intuitive eating than women are in the U.S. Additionally, some of these health behaviors that intuitive eating has been linked to, things like eating disorder symptomology, the research is much stronger in women. It's a little bit less known what the impact between intuitive eating and some of these other health behaviors are among men. Additionally, one last reason to stratify by gender is simply that the U.S. dietary guidelines differ by gender. So that was one reason to, again, stratify. Overall, we compared the mean daily dietary intake across each intuitive eating quartile, and then we adjusted for age, ethnicity, race, socioeconomic status, and then total caloric intake. Additionally, because loss to follow-up didn't occur completely at randomly in this sample, as it rarely does in you know, longitudinal studies that go on for this long, we made sure to use sample weights using response propensities so that the population was more reflective and generalizable to the original school-based population. Next slide, please. So this is the weighted sample characteristics. Overall, participants were on average 31 years old. Slightly less, or really about 50% of the sample was white. There are also substantial proportions of Black and Asian participants. In terms of education, about 45% of women and 40% of men had a bachelor's degree or higher. And in terms of income, the breakdown was, you know, the vast majority of participants, 80% had either family incomes of lower than $50,000 or between $50,000 and $100,000. Next slide. In terms of intuitive eating quartiles, of course, ideally your quartiles would be exactly 25% each, but it doesn't always work out that way just because of the way the, you know, scale is done. So there were about 25% and 26% of participants in the least intuitive group. But the less intuitive group and the somewhat intuitive groups didn't have quite that 25% breakdown because, for instance, if you can imagine all participants who score, say, a 20 out of 28 have to be put in the same group regardless of how many there are. So that is the reason for the less intuitive group only having about 17 and 18% of participants and the somewhat intuitive group having about 31% of participants. But overall, still a relatively even quartile breakdown for intuitive eating. Next slide, please. So what did we see? Overall, these are the results shown for women, for fruit, vegetables, whole grains, dairy, and sugar-sweetened beverages. And these are daily servings based on the FFQ. Overall, for women, we saw that women in the highest level of intuitive eating had about 0.6 servings more fruit and 0.4 servings more vegetables daily than those in the lowest level of intuitive eating. And both of these differences were statistically significant. We didn't see any differences in whole grains, dairy, or sugar-sweetened beverages. Excuse me. Next slide, please. In terms of some of our other daily dietary components, there were no statistically significant differences in protein, calories, total fat, and saturated fat based on intuitive eating quartile. However, there were some trends. So we did see that, for instance, protein and saturated fat were both slightly lower in the most intuitive group compared to the least intuitive group. But, you know, these were only trends, and certainly the results would need to be replicated to confirm whether or not this is really accurate. All right, next slide, please. Next, we'll move to the results in men. So similarly to the results in women, we saw that men who reported eating intuitively consumed 0.3 servings more fruit and 0.6 servings more vegetables daily compared to those who reported not eating intuitively. However, one of the sort of less positive results is that men in the most intuitive group consume 0.6 servings fewer whole grains than those in the least intuitive group. And again, dairy and sugar-sweetened beverage consumption did not change based on intuitive eating quartile. Next slide. Okay. In terms of some of those other dietary components, protein, calories, total fat, and saturated fat, among men, there was not even a trend. You know, these components were simply not related in any way, shape, or form to intuitive eating quartiles among men based on the results that we found. All right, with that, I believe we will transition to Vivian, who is going to go through some of the overall discussion points and implications for research and practice.
Thank you. And first, I just have to say, Mary, those figures are beautiful. So great job with those. Okay, so in terms of intuitive eating and dietary markers, we found that intuitive eating was related to modestly higher intakes of some of the key food groups that are recommended by the 2015-2020 dietary guidelines, namely fruits and vegetables, and these findings were found among both women and men. We did find, though, that among men, intuitive eating seemed to be somewhat inversely associated with whole grain consumption. So those in the top quartile for intuitive eating consume slightly fewer whole grains compared to those in the lowest intuitive eating quartile. So it seems like the relationship between intuitive eating and dietary intake may differ across dietary components. Notably, though, intuitive eating was not related to intake of dietary components that the 2015-2020 dietary guidelines advise limiting, such as sugar-sweetened beverages and saturated fat. Something we noticed was that associations in our study were more consistent across genders compared with prior research. So in the Nutrinet Sante study, higher levels of reliance on hunger and satiety cues had been found to be associated with lower energy intake and higher whole grain intake among women, but not among men. In the Swiss food panel study, eating for physical rather than emotional reasons and reliance on hunger and satiety cues were both correlated with dietary quality among women, but not among men. And in a prior study of college students, reliance on hunger and satiety cues was related to lower consumption of fruit and vegetable intake among men, but not women. But again, we found quite consistent findings across women and men in this study. So overall, the EAT4 results suggest that intuitive eating is modestly associated with some markers of better dietary intake, but not consistently associated with all markers of a healthy diet. Overall, though, findings add to the growing body of evidence for the potential benefits of intuitive eating. Oops. With regard to energy intake, we found that caloric intake did not differ by intuitive eating quartiles. And this had, again, been a relationship that had been fairly unclear from prior research. So again, quoting the Nutrinet Sante study, reliance on hunger and satiety cues had been found to be associated with lower energy intake, and that was assessed through multiple 24-hour dietary recalls. That study also found unconditional permission to eat was associated with higher energy intake. In laboratory studies, intuitive eating has previously been found to be related to increased meal consumption, but unrelated to the intake of healthy foods or overall food intake. So although there have been some small studies raising concern that intuitive eating could be associated with greater energy intake, the findings from this EAT4 study suggest that at the population level, intuitive eating, and especially reliance on hunger and satiety cues, which made up the largest bulk of the questions assessed in this study, specifically were not related to higher energy intake. Some limitations of this study are worth noting. It was cross-sectional data that we used for this study, although we drew upon a longitudinal cohort study. We did just use cross-sectional data from that fourth wave of data collection. Another limitation is that the sample was drawn from one geographic area and was somewhat limited in terms of the racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic distribution. So we need to be cautious when trying to generalize to other geographic areas and to more diverse racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic backgrounds. Another limitation is that dietary intake was self-reported using a semi-quantitative food frequency questionnaire. So it didn't precisely measure the volume of sugar-sweetened beverages or total caloric intake like other assessment methods like multiple 24-hour dietary recalls would. However, the food frequency questionnaire that we used has been validated, and it allowed us to comprehensively measure the usual intake usual daily intake for the past year. Still, we need rigorous assessment of dietary intake to assess the relationship between intuitive eating and alignment with biological requirements. So this population-based analysis that measured the relationship between intuitive eating and daily servings of food components in the U.S. dietary guidelines among a large sample of young adult men and women found that intuitive eating showed modestly beneficial cross-sectional associations with dietary intake, and that while intuitive eating was associated with lower intake of whole grains among men, it was not associated with higher intake of low nutrient, energy dense foods like sugar sweetened beverages. These findings, considered in the context of prior research suggesting a wide range of benefits of intuitive eating, suggest that intuitive eating may provide a healthy alternative to popular yet problematic practices such as dieting and the use of unhealthy weight control practices such as fasting, using diet pills, and other problematic practices. There are several future directions for research. Again, this was a cross-sectional study, so we're not able to determine the directionality of the relationship between intuitive eating and dietary intake. To understand this, we need longitudinal research to understand the long-term relationship between intuitive eating and dietary intake. It would also be incredibly valuable to conduct qualitative studies to determine which groups may benefit most from intuitive eating interventions, and also to understand the impact of contextual factors such as home and community food environment and social behaviors. Research is also needed to examine the impact of food environments characterized by low-cost foods that are low in nutritional density, because these environments could make healthful intuitive eating more challenging. In terms of implications for practice, the findings from this study suggest that clinicians should guide young people toward intuitive eating while also helping them align their dietary intake in accordance with the U.S. or other dietary guidelines. Thank you. I think we have some time for questions.
Thank you so much. So for our people listening in, if you can type your questions into the question box. One question that I had, and this is the part where you were comparing your study to other studies, and some of the other studies, for instance, found that there was an increase in caloric intake with intuitive eating, whereas you did not find that. Do you happen to know if those studies were an intuitive eating intervention or just looking at intuitive eating like yours did? I wonder if there's a difference based on, and this is, again, I'm just wanting to hear your feedback on this, but I wonder if there's a difference in the results in people who naturally eat intuitively as you were looking at versus people who have been, maybe don't naturally eat intuitively, and then now they've been guided to.
Sure. So I think all of the studies that we looked at in terms of, you know, referencing other dietary intake studies, all of these were observational or, you know, either observational cohort studies or cross-sectional studies, or in the case of the laboratory studies, they, you know, observed how much people ate at that specific meal that they were provided, but none of them were interventions. So the intervention research certainly would probably produce different results. I'm sure you're right that you might see different different results, especially, you know, in the context of, you know, you're given a meal within a laboratory setting. You know, does that really reflect how much you're going to eat naturally day to day in your home environment? You know, maybe not. I completely agree. With an intervention, you're likely to see different results, especially in terms of total caloric intake, versus, you know, people who are sort of naturally just eating more intuitively. Vivian, Nicole, any additional thoughts?
I think you covered that.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good summary.
So then another question we have, one of your conclusions is that intuitive eating may provide a healthy alternative to popular yet problematic practices such as dieting and use of unhealthy weight control practices. What is the desired outcome of intuitive eating if used as an alternative to those practices? Is the goal weight control, for example?
Well, I mean, it probably depends on what your overall goal is. But broadly speaking, you know, probably not. Broadly speaking, the overall goal with intuitive eating is much more of this holistic approach that focuses on, you know, eating only foods that really are going to nourish you, eating as you know, until you feel full. So I think weight control is in some ways maybe more of a bonus. Lots of cross-sectional studies have found that, not just cross-sectional, lots of interventions have found that intuitive eating is related to improved weight control, or lower BMI or lower weight status. I think the overall goal is much more of just, you know, healthy nutrition and improved dietary intake versus, you know, it hitting sort of a specific weight, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
Any additions, team?
It's a tricky question. I think you answered it well. I think it's hard to say that you would approach intuitive eating for the purpose of weight loss, but yeah, I think the research does generally suggest that if you approach intuitive eating in the right way, it may end up resulting in weight loss, but that is generally not the focus, the goal.
Yeah, and it, from the looks of it, the question is specifically in the context of providing an alternative to people who are dieting and to people who are using unhealthy weight control practices. What is their goal? I think, I don't know if the person who asked the question wants to add more clarity to that, but
yeah. Well, for that as specifically an alternative, you know, 100%, if you're really trying to think about how to improve your diet and without really restrictive dieting or rules, absolutely taking a much more intuitive approach and it's a great alternative based on the research in this study and in some others, but you know, it doesn't come without any caveats, of course, and it needs to be better studied for sure. But again, as an alternative to less healthy practices, I think it would be hard not to recommend intuitive eating.
Yeah. For this was a cross-sectional study. Are there plans in the future to do another wave and look at this longitudinally in this cohort?
Yeah, well, one of the issues with, not issues, one of the sort of limitations was that, you know, ideally, you know, this would have been longitudinal, but the intuitive eating measure at EAT3 only involved a couple questions, so it didn't involve that whole subscale of intuitive eating that we had at EAT4. So for sure, you know, it pending data availability, it would be great to extend this to a longitudinal study to really get at that, the long-term impact. Nicole, do you have any, can you share any of the plans for EAT5?
Well, I think, you know, a thought I have about this study also, and something we considered in the design as to whether to include the earlier wave of data, which didn't as fully assess intuitive eating, was with regard to the thought that the EAST study survey assessments are spaced 5 or more years apart, with, as since we've been following the participants from adolescence to adulthood. And unless you know when they started engaging in intuitive eating to the extent that they are now, it's hard to relate that to your dietary intake 5 years later. It actually made a little more sense to us for the design of this study to capture how your dietary intake at the time of the survey was aligned with your intuitive eating practices at that time. I certainly agree that a longitudinal study might help making some stronger temporal associations, but it might need to be done within a survey population where the surveys happen to be spaced a little closer together.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us today, for sharing. I know I learned a lot listening to your project. So thank you for your time and your expertise. And at this point, I can hand it back to Rachel.
Yes, thank you all very much. Just a reminder, there'll be a short survey when I close out the webinar. I appreciate your feedback. And then watch for an email later this week as a follow-up with a link to the recording, the handout, and your CEU certificate. And then Journal Club is happening every Monday. It's not until November that we have an early webinar. So if you go on the SNEB website, please register for next Monday session, which will be 1 p.m. Eastern. So thank you all for attending today.